morning. It is Wednesday, the 22nd of February, the wettest February on record, and it's not raining today.
Yes.
This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and we are here to continue our discussion of education with Mr. Capps and Dr. Noor, and who else are we going to bring up? And your computer, we're on page 34 of the presentation that started on the 20th. So, proceed.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, for the record, Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer. Continuing on in our conversation around the Seamless System and some of our interagency initiatives to focus today on educator workforce and here with the leadership that reflects that across education agencies. Obviously, a critical foundation of our work in supporting our educators is a recognition that they are the most important in-school factor impacting student achievement and success. And we believe we have a very important commitment to make to supporting our educators between our pre-K and K-12 systems. And as we talked a little bit about in our conversation around the pre-K through third grade transition, the opportunity for us to create better collaboration across those systems. We know that one of the critical opportunities that we have as we think about this work from a state perspective, whether from a system perspective or programs perspective, is the opportunity to do a better job of reflecting educator perspective and educator leadership in teaching and learning and in continuous improvement. And so some of our work that we'll talk about relative to supporting educators has that important goal in mind. We also believe it's incredibly important for us to continue to support a more diverse workforce that reflects the students that we are serving in our schools and early childhood contexts, and making sure that we are more culturally responsive to ensure that students have the relevant and engaging learning opportunities that they need to be successful. This legislature has done an incredible amount of work over the last decade to really give a focus to our educator workforce, you know, beginning with work around creating a statewide mentor program. We saw the creation of school district collaboration grants that were intended to bring teachers and school leaders together to develop professional learning systems within school districts. We've seen new work now around supporting school principals and other school administrators in their leadership abilities. I think what we're trying to do going forward is to really think about how we make that not a siloed system, but one where those elements are reflected in school districts across the state. Since 2013, we have funded these programs through the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning with an appropriation of upwards of $45 million in the 2013-15 biennium. And I think we currently have about $37 million available as we head into the 17-19 session. But we want to talk a little bit more about how those resources might be reallocated going forward. The other piece I want to just focus on briefly before turning it over to my colleagues is to talk a little bit about the Educator Equity Act. We have a mandate within the Chief Education Office to do annual reporting on the diversity of our workforce, and we know that the trend data for 31 of Oregon's most diverse school districts and the completion rates of diverse teacher candidates are improving. But there's much more work to do. And in that work, we continue to engage a diverse group of 22 educators, policy leaders, and community members who continue to advise us on strategies to improve the diversity of our workforce. With that, I'll turn it over to our Teacher Standards and Practices Director, Monica Bean.
Monica, welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee, for the record, I am Monica Bean, Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. As Lindsay Capps just mentioned, we are ensuring that a seamless system does exist for our pre-K through post-secondary education programs. One of the roles that TSPC plays in this is through the national accreditation process. And standard two of that process requires that our institutions of higher education have partnerships with K-12 districts. And so in those partnerships, it's important that the induction components align with the mentoring standards that are adopted by the state. And so that's really a role that TSPC plays in ensuring that alignment. Another thing that we do is making sure that the programs are preparing teachers to be learner ready day one, and that cannot happen again without those strong partnerships with the K-12 and the early learning systems. And so excuse me, in looking at the licensure redesign process in the last year and a half, it's been very cumbersome for educators to navigate the licensure system. So by redesigning that process and utilizing the partnerships between K-12 and higher ed, it's actually making it more reasonable and more appropriate for the learning environment for those students. So that's really the role that we have, and I'm going to keep it very brief because I know we have lots to do today.
Thank you. Chairman Rowe, Chair Smith-Warner, committee, for the record, I'm David Mandel, Acting Early Learning System Director. I just wanted to touch a little bit around the place of the early learning workforce in this conversation, and I can't tell you how excited I am for that to be part of this conversation. As I mentioned in my first presentation, there are over 20,000 adults in Oregon who work with young children. They are the heart and soul of early learning. And not only is the early learning workforce more diverse than the K-12 workforce, it's actually more diverse than our adult population, but a little bit less diverse than our 0-5 population. And this diversity is a really great asset that we have the opportunity to capitalize. At the same time, the early learning workforce has had limited access to training and coaching, and pathways to degrees have been really littered with multiple stumbling blocks. Oregon's early learning workforce, I think, also has traditionally not been part of this conversation about supporting educators. So this is a really exciting opportunity for the early learning workforce to be both part of this conversation and a unique opportunity to start addressing some of the crucial needs of this particular workforce.
Good morning. Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I'm also mindful of the constraints of time this morning, so I'm going to be very highly brief in my comments. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning and what the network actually represents. And this, as Lindsay indicated, it was established in by the 2013 legislature, and it really acts as a statewide umbrella for supporting our teachers and administrators. There has been tremendous investments in the quality of instruction and the quality of educators that we have in our state as a result of this network. It provides professional development and professional learning opportunities to educators, as well as career pathways for teacher leadership and advancement. We also use the network to identify best practices to scale up and promote and share those practices statewide. One of the programs that you all, I'm sure, are familiar with is our mentoring program. And it's been really lauded both at a state level and national level that we actually have a program like that supports teachers and administrators in their development and growth. What I can tell you that as a result of the mentoring program, we have impacted over 123,000 students as a result of this mentoring program, and what we believe that leads to improved instruction and improving the quality of teachers and teaching and learning in our classrooms. I can also tell you that as a result of the collaboration grants that are also supported by the network, we see that students in those schools have higher levels of achievement, and especially on test scores compared to other students and other schools. So that is a significant impact as well. Part of the network is also supplementing some of the federal funds that we receive for schools and districts that are in improvement status. And what I will tell you is that 73% of those schools, focus and priority schools, serving about 35,000 students, saw significant improvements in the academic achievement of those students and the systems that they've implemented as a result of these school and district improvement grants. And since those are designated as focus and priority by the federal standard, if that standard were to be lifted, 73% of those schools will no longer be in that designation based on the academic gains that students have made. So the network has had a tremendous impact on the workforce, including the diversification of the workforce, as my colleagues discussed here, but it had a direct impact on students and the performance of those students as well. Thank you.
Dr. Noor, Representative Comp and I became aware of some of the statistics a few years ago that one out of every four teachers were dropping out of teaching within 4 years, and we pushed for the teacher mentoring program. One of our goals was to preserve the investment in those young teachers and keep them in the profession as long as they were successful. We also learned that mentoring was important to younger principals as well.
Yes.
People that were moving up to that level also needed mm-hmm. mentoring often, and so putting them with a mentor, a more experienced person, seemed to benefit. Do you have any evidence yet on whether or not retention of teachers and principals because of the mentoring program is occurring?
Co-Chair Monroe, I believe we do have some information that we will be happy to share with you. We've had a contract with they have a new name now at Western Oregon University to evaluate the mentoring program.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be teaching research and may still be teaching research. So we have a contract with them to evaluate the program and the effectiveness of that program, and I would be happy to go back and see if that is a data point that we collect and provide that to the committee. I will tell you from my own experience in the Salem-Keizer School District is that we saw an increase in the retention rate of teachers as a result of mentoring.
Yeah.
And we saw exactly what you described, that new, younger teachers in particular needed and wanted to be paired with a veteran, seasoned teacher. And they benefited tremendously from that, and we did see an increase in the retention rates in our staff. But I will provide you the information relative to the mentoring program and trends and retention, et cetera. So,
well, I'd appreciate that, because having had something to do with that that program happening, I want to know if I did good or not.
Yeah. And I know many, many teachers and administrators thank you for that, because it's a tremendous investment that we're very proud of.
So. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Since this is new, this is a new area I'm in, I just have a short question. I'm trying to understand, and I appreciate you said that the trend data is improving, or the diversity of the workforce, and especially K-12, but I'm trying to understand, so what specific, because I go back to, as I talk to my district and that about the availability of a diverse application pool versus others. So what specifically, what steps are we taking or have we taken to try to increase that workforce to reflect more of the community?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I think there are a couple of areas where I think we're seeing improvement. First and foremost is through, I think, our Teach Oregon grants that have been done through the network, which we haven't mentioned previously, but looking at ways of how we put recruitment strategies in place as early as middle school. Springfield School District is a great example where they've attempted to do that, to identify teacher candidates, you know, students with a disposition that they believe would make them great teachers, and students of color, to try to move them through. We'll have a little bit more of a discussion about this through the Chief Education Office presentation upcoming, but I think it's really thinking really proactively about how we're creating pathways into the profession. And some of that's also providing affordable pathways into teaching. And there's some great examples around the state that we'll talk a little bit about.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So one of the things I hear as it relates to, you know, how do you get teachers in the classroom that look like the kids in the classroom, is that we are struggling to have students of color go into the teaching profession as it is. And I guess the question I have is, wouldn't it make sense, particularly for non-core classes, that we would allow people without teaching degrees to come in and teach those classes? I mean, right now there is a absolute barrier. If you've got a master's degree in some other field and you want to come teach an elective-based education, it seems to me that the way to increase teachers of color is to bring them in from other fields, let them teach some of those elective classes, give them a pathway that doesn't require them to go back and get another master's degree. And I think that you would increase that population of teachers very quickly, and then show students that there are folks in industries who are leaders in their own industries, and have them be able to impart that knowledge. And it seems that other states are doing this. They've been able to more rapidly accelerate the numbers of teachers of color who are in their classrooms because they've opened up that pathway wide open, and we still have this very protectionist attitude about who can be in a classroom. And so are we exploring that as an option?
I think I'll defer that to the teachers'
Monica,
standards of practice,
right?
Since that's under their jurisdiction.
Excuse me. Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish. We absolutely are exploring some opportunities to enable those people who have content knowledge to come into the classroom. We currently have a restricted license that allows that thing at this point. So if a district has a course that they would like to have taught by someone who is an expert, there is a pathway for that exists. It's not very commonly utilized. And again, they would have to go through the background investigation to make sure that the children are in fact safe. We also have the career and technical education routes, which does exactly that. Someone who comes from a trade, who is an experienced welder or engineer that wants to transition as a classroom teacher, there's a pathway for that as well. So I look forward to growing these pathways. I come from a state where there are alternative routes to licensure. The important thing is that the pedagogy is not slighted, in that we don't set these particular people up for failure because they have not been supported in their teaching of their trade or content.
Go ahead.
So on those other pathways, though, do they, I mean, because as I've looked at those before, it seems like some of them ultimately require them to go get the master's degree. They do or they don't?
Okay, good. Co-chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, Representative Parrish. No, currently the master's degree is no longer required in the state of Oregon for a teaching license.
We did that last session.
That was last session. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Can you elaborate on that?
Dr. Knorr?
So, Mr. Co-chair, Madam Co-chair, very briefly, I think that the process that Monica is referring to relative to career technical education is called the instructor appraisal process. And you are likely to walk into many career technical education programs and courses today that are taught by somebody from industry. They have to go through, they get their license, they have to go through a process at the local level to determine if they're qualified. Once they're determined to be qualified, they don't have to pursue a master's degree, they have to go through a professional development program that essentially provides them knowledge and skills relative to pedagogy, classroom management, curriculum delivery, so they don't have to go through the entire program. And I was in Redmond actually earlier in January, and I think every single teacher that they have in their CTE programs came from industry. None of them have gone through the traditional route. So,
okay. One last follow-up.
Go ahead.
So are we moving that direction for other classes that aren't necessarily STEM direct, you know, education? Or CTE education, I'm thinking more higher sciences and things that, particularly around being able to use that as a tool for TAG kids who currently maybe aren't getting a very robust curriculum in some of their high school programs.
Sure. Co-Chair Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish, we do have options available, especially for those shortage areas or districts where they cannot find a licensed educator. Yeah. That's the intent of that pathway. But as that becomes more and more of an issue statewide, I I estimate that that will increase. However, the question that you posed about just having an alternative route for licensure, we have to be mindful that we do have 60,000 licensed educators in the state of Oregon currently. And so we have to ask, are there already licensed educators of color and of minority and that could possibly fill those positions currently without having to delve into deeper alternative routes? So we have a lot of opportunities for exploration, and I certainly will take this back to my commission to explore that during the April meeting as well.
Well, I think we had a hearing the other day about requiring financial education. Now, whether there's somebody of color or not who can teach that, even if you have a licensed educator, can they really teach high finance? Is that something they have subject matter expertise? So when I hear us want to put new things in the curriculum, I think do we actually have teachers who can teach that? And, you know, time value of money or whatever. I mean, I have an MBA right now. I really couldn't go in and walk in and teach a finance class in any high school in Oregon that I know of. And so so those are the types of pathways. And I do think you then pull down professional people of color back into those classrooms if we give them a path to do that, and especially if we're asking our high schools to take on more curriculum components, we're going to have to find other ways to pull, because you could have a licensed teacher who does not have subject matter expertise to deliver that in a quality way to kids, and that is a concern for me.
Absolutely.
Three high school kids.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, just a statement. As a high school principal, there was never a time that TSPC or other avenues were not available to get any teacher I wanted. I there are people who use that as an excuse, and I've seen that done a lot, but the reality is all of the deals with technical education, we had an engineer that was in pistachios who wanted to be a math teacher, and we were able to get him certified and in the classroom. He only lasted a year because he didn't realize it was such hard work for low pay. So he sent our schools pistachios for a few years after that to say, I'm having a great time down here. I make a living for my family, and I have extra pistachios. So here you go. Because we had a lot of conversations about trying to get people from industry. The issue is we don't pay as well as industry, and it's really hard work. And a lot of the people who come out of the industry thinking it's going to be, you know, a great deal for them don't last very long. And that has to do with a number of things. Pedagogy is one of them. They really didn't understand what they were getting into when they had 30 kids in a classroom teaching math. They got the subject matter down. They don't necessarily have management of kids down. So you really have to invest in that. But there's always, as long as I've been in the state, there have always been ways to get talented people in the classroom. Now, that doesn't mean the administrators can do that easily. Sometimes it takes a little bit of work. And in vocational, it's gotten easier, actually, because it used to be you had to get the big team set up. You had to do all that kind of stuff and a lot of evaluation to get there. And I had a father that came from industry and carpentry to be a carpentry instructor in Washington. So they've always been there. And so it frustrates me at times when people think that we haven't tried to make those pathways available, in large part, I believe, because people haven't been willing to do the work to make it happen. And they discount much of what teachers have learned in their profession about what it's like to manage a group of kids. And I would say it's easier, my perspective, at the high school level than it is in middle school and elementary. I give those people a lot of credit. I mean, these are really hard jobs, and it has as much to do with managing the classroom and doing those things as it does with the knowledge you have. High school, its knowledge can be really helpful. And our best vocational people have all come from industry. I mean, I don't know if out of high school we had a few that had degrees, but they were also in industry and they made those decisions. But I'm happy. I think you're doing a really great job at TSPC. I really appreciate and I hope we keep exploring ways to do it. But I think what people forget is that the profession of teaching is a really difficult job to do it right in the situations we're in right now, and we have to honor some of the skills that go into being that great teacher. So that's just my editorial.
I remember I knew history inside and out, but learning how to teach took a while. We need to keep moving.
Yep.
It's our fault, but go ahead.
They accept full responsibility.
So I thought what I would do, I know that there's a need to move on now to specific agency budgets, and really just sum up maybe for the committee a little bit of strategically how we're thinking about the education budget as you all do your work. And I think you've heard over the last 2 days kind of where we are strategically focusing our efforts. I think one of the key principles of the governor, as we have advised her around the budget, all of us collectively, is really focusing on a seamless system of education, as we've talked about. And what we think that means is ensuring that we don't look at these budgets as separate. So if we think about the early learning budget with, you know, $257.3 million in general fund, we want to ensure that we maintain that current service level so that we are maintaining the opportunities for high-quality preschool, for other important critical programs that are supporting children and families in that those early years of a child's life. We want to maintain current service level funding for our public schools through the state school fund. The governor's budget is advocating for, you know, $8.015 billion, which is about a 9% increase over the legislatively adopted budget. We know there's potentially more work to do, and we would look forward to working with this committee to do that. We have to maintain the almost historic increases that this legislature made in both the Community College Support Fund and the Public University Support Fund to maintain opportunities for our students in higher education. And we understand that the dollars that the governor has recommended really keep us at a flat funded level. But we believe all sectors need to have a basic level of support going forward. We also believe, importantly, that specific targeted investments that oftentimes are delivered through grant and aid programs are critically important. And we certainly see those programs being critical going forward, as well as thinking about ways in which we begin, most especially around high school graduation, to work with schools and communities to replicate effective practices and help to build systems that will allow us to support students meeting success. The early indicator or early warning system is a great example that we need to begin scaling up and replicating. There's resources in Senate Bill 183 and the Graduation Equity Fund to begin doing that, and that ties in with our efforts across every region of the state to begin really organizing our efforts across schools and communities around attendance. And that's also supported. And then I think a third critical piece that that links certainly our work in early learning into the K-12 system is how are we addressing adverse childhood experiences through trauma-informed practices, because we see increasingly that's where the gap is with our students. And so if we can begin to integrate that, not only in terms of behavioral supports that our students have, but in instructional strategies, that could be really incredible work in terms of closing the gap that we see every year with those 12,000 students who are not graduating on time. So that is an item that we have advocated for, that we look forward to working with you on to fund. We have made the recommendation that actually come out of the state school fund. And I know that will be a discussion, but we believe it's critically important to begin putting in place some best practices. We've talked just now about excellent teaching, how we better link the early learning and K-12 system. We need to build a statewide system. We've done great work through the leadership of folks even in this room around supporting excellent teaching. I think now it's time to, how do we create networks to support teachers in really continuously improving instruction and getting to better student outcomes with a focus on equity? And that's what Senate Bill 182 and the Educator Advancement Council is intending to do, and by leveraging a new public nonprofit partnership to help us get that done. Career-connected learning. We certainly believe that Measure 98 is an opportunity for us to move that work along within career and technical education. We can't forget that also helps to build capacity around graduation in terms of dual credit opportunities as well that we've talked about, and certainly in other dropout prevention strategies. We've done work cross-agency to think through what might be some improvements to help the implementation of that measure, especially as it comes to smaller districts and rural communities in terms of that. And we have not recommended full funding, in part because we believe we've got to maintain system-wide funding first and foremost across all sectors. But that obviously will be an area of conversation with the legislature. And alongside that career fund, connected learning through 98, we still see a critical place for our regional networks, whether around CTE or STEM, to really help build capacity and link us to business and industry and regional workforce goals. So those are things that we'll continue to talk about. Last piece I'll focus on, and Ben Cannon was here yesterday to talk a little bit about this, is ensuring that we do better in terms of need-based aid for our students. We are well below the national average in the support that we give to our students. As we continue to structure our work in higher ed to focus on our underserved students, our students of color, our rural students, making sure that we have need-based aid for them, either through the Oregon Promise, which we know, we just saw a report come out last week that shows that's actually helping to move students on a college track, which is great news for our state. But we also need to be thinking, in addition to fully funding the Oregon Promise, about expanding the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And we've recommended $151 million for that. If we fund it at that level, we will award 85,000 grants out to the state for folks to attend a community college, university, both public or private. So those are some of the priorities. Obviously, these are opportunities. The challenges, I think, are probably clear to this subcommittee in terms of resources, and we're certainly committed to continue to talk about revenue opportunities to support this, and efforts that we can undertake to contain costs within the educational system, and move us toward measurable outcomes for our students. So we appreciate the time that we've had with all of you to talk about our education overview from a systemic perspective, and obviously look forward to continue to work with you through this budget process. So thank you very much.
Good. Representative Wisnett.
Been quiet today. Thank you for the presentations, and I'm committed to continuing to work to help our teachers, and enjoyed and appreciate Dr. Beam's work with me and Representative Barbara Smith Warner on that. I appreciate CEO Capps and your ending comments about looking for efficiencies and things. I made a comment earlier on that. Is the governor's office prepared to discuss and look at changing the insurance system in our school districts, which I'm told by Representative Mark Johnson would save and put the $200 million that we're looking for to put back in the education budget?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, I appreciate the question. That particular issue is not in my portfolio, but I would be happy to come back to you and have a conversation with you about that. I think we recognize that there are cost drivers in the system. If we look at the just the state school fund in terms of its CSL, we have drivers in there around both PERS and healthcare. So we're certainly open to looking at that issue.
Thank you.
Okay, where are we? Moving on.
Mr. Chair, I think this overview is completed.
Okay.
And we'll move on to the budget bill for Chief Education Office. So we'll need to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 554.
Open a public hearing on 5522.
And, Mr. Chair, you'll find under today's materials on OLIS a few presentation documents. There's the two-pager from us that I'll go over real briefly, and then the entitled Senate Bill 5522 CEO presentation is what will be up on the screen, which I think Lindsay will start walking through in a minute. In terms of our view on this, is just some real quick background. Chief Education Office is its predecessor was the OEIB, Oregon Education Investment Board, Senate Bill 215 from last 2015, was a product of a work group from Senator Roblin leading on that created the Chief Education Officer. It kept the Chief Education Officer. Mr. Capps plays two roles. He's that position, but he's also the governor's policy advisor. Keep in mind that their role is for coordinating and collaborating with educators and various stakeholders to provide a seamless and unified public education system, the P-20 system. Chief Education Office, as a result of Senate Bill 215, is scheduled to sunset at the end of the next biennium. There are various models. That's something that you probably should discuss and keep in the back of your mind as Mr. Capps provides his presentation, that the decision will, you can either start making the decision this biennium or wait until next session. But it seems to me that you need to keep that in the back of your mind. Another issue that you keep in front of you, you'll hear about today or tomorrow, is a statewide longitudinal data system that is getting further along toward completion in terms of providing data for students and programs all the way from early learning all the way through post-secondary education. Has a ways to go in filling the data, but they're getting close on the post-secondary and K through 12 systems. The early learning has a lot further to go, and over time it's hoped that that links with employment data and even health data and other programs in state government. So with that, I think turning it over to Mr. Capps would be in line.
Mr. Capps, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer. We'll present to you over the next day or so in the following key areas. So first we'll do a agency overview, talk a little bit more about our role cradle to career in terms of providing strategic leadership to the system. We'll go into some detail about the key functions of the agency, and I will invite some of our policy directors to come talk about that work, and then we'll finish with our policy option packages and talk about that. We've talked a little bit about the role of the Chief Education Office. Obviously, our job, as it's been constituted under Senate Bill 215, is to continue to build and coordinate a seamless system of education that meets the diverse learning needs of every Oregonian from cradle to career. One of our clear statutory authorities working with our partner agencies and across sectors is to both advance equity, equitable opportunity and outcomes within the system, and certainly to help develop a culturally responsive system of education. And certainly our vision aligns with that purpose in terms of ensuring that each and every Oregon student is ready to learn on track and prepared for their future. With regard to our statutory charges under Senate Bill 215, as I've mentioned before, our key role is really cross-agency planning tied to achieving critical student outcomes with a key focus around key student transitions. So we've talked about the pre-K through third grade transition as well as the grade 11 through 14 transition, and we'll talk more about that today. We have a research function in terms of charges that we have been given specifically from the legislature, which we'll talk a little bit more about today through various pieces of legislation, as well as thinking about research across the P20 continuum, most especially tied to critical benchmarks across a student's learning continuum, things like third grade reading, ninth grade on track, high school graduation. And we work in that capacity not only with the research unit within our agency, but with researchers across state agencies. We are involved in helping to develop a coordinated system to link and analyze student data, and doing that through cross-sector engagement, not only in terms of the research that we are doing, but tying that then to policy proposals that we bring forward to the legislature or can move through the administrative functions of the state agencies. And ultimately, I think our goal is to really help work with agencies and sectors to figure out how we accelerate student outcomes. So in our coordinating, convening, and strategic planning capacity, we not only work with the agencies that you've seen here, but we also work with the Oregon Employment Department. We work with the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services as needed on various issues. We work with stakeholders from early learning through higher education, as well as our regional collaborative partners across the state, most especially through our regional achievement collaboratives, and ultimately with the governor and the legislature. So here is our short agency history since 2011. In 2011, obviously, the 40-40-20 goal was established for the state. The Oregon Education Investment Board was created under Senate Bill 909 with very specific authority to have oversight over the P20 system. In that same year, Senate Bill 1581 created the Chief Education Officer position appointed by the governor with the authority, directive authority, over each of the education agency leads, and at that point in time, the chancellor of our Oregon University system. I'll jump ahead to 2015 to just talk about that transition, which I think we've referenced a little bit previously, which is that we've essentially removed the board as in its oversight function, and the role of the Chief Education Officer under Senate Bill 215 has been changed to serve in a planning and coordinating function, as well as being assigned other duties by the governor. So one of those has been to also work with an education cabinet across state agencies and advise the governor on education policy, help her with specific governor priorities around policy, and put together a unified P20 budget. To some specific functions that have been created, I'll go back to 2013. House Bill 2636 created the STEM Investment Council. We'll talk a little bit more about that council coming up in terms of its goals, but it essentially makes recommendations to the Chief Education Office on strategies to improve STEM education opportunities and goals around both student achievement in the K-12 system and post-secondary degree attainment. House Bill 3232 gave the Chief Education Office authority around specific strategic investments, including our P3 transition, our early literacy programs, looking at STEM and CTE programs, which is connected with our STEM Investment Council, and looking at 11 through 14 transition programs. House Bill 3233 gave the Chief Education Office strategic direction over the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning with administration through the Oregon Department of Education. And Senate Bill 755 provided for our agency to do a biennial report on the educator workforce, working with partner agencies and stakeholders. Moving to 2016, House Bill 4002 assigned our agency with putting into the field a trauma-informed pilot. We are working with two school districts currently to put in place trauma-informed practices within two high schools. There is also a cohort of high schools around the state that are part of that process, learning from the two pilot high schools.
And what are those high schools?
Tigard High School in the Tigard-Tualatin School District and Central High School in the Central School District.
Okay.
Independence. And then last but not least, we were charged with working with the Oregon Department of Education to look into practices that would support low-income students across the state, and we've recently submitted that report for your review. So now I'll turn to some of our agency strategic goals. First and foremost, in our coordinating capacity, working with state agencies through interagency planning teams and between agency directors in planning and policy development to achieve statewide goals for student learning outcomes. Some of the things that we are advancing through that process are certainly looking at ongoing development of educational goals across early learning, K-12, higher education, and the workforce. Looking to expand student access to personalized pathways of learning. We've talked a little bit about this in our overall presentation in terms of how we're expanding access to career technical and STEM education and dual credit opportunities, but most especially for historically underserved communities. Working through both our regional partnerships and through policy to strengthen student and family engagement. This is a particularly important piece of work in terms of our high school graduation initiatives, but they certainly are reflected across the system in terms of achieving better school readiness, attendance, and completion. Our focus, a charge given to us by the governor through the innovation officer who serves in the chief education office, to improve student high school graduation outcomes by working to identify and scale up effective practices. Senate Bill 183 is a result of that strategy, and there is ongoing work that we see over time to expand that work. Research and evaluate effective practices, interventions, and strategies to support policy development for student success. I would say that some of our work around trauma-informed practices is aiding in that effort. And last but not least, an integrated statewide student-centered longitudinal data system that we are currently building within our agency, and we'll talk a little bit in more detail about that later in the presentation. Our second area of focus in terms of strategic goals is coordinating integrated cross-sector systems that support student success. Part of this work is certainly reflected in our efforts to, as you look at item D, foster regional coordination and cross-sector collaboration. This is really critical work of our regional achievement collaboratives, our early learning hubs. And we see this as an area in which we can look to help support students in addressing non-academic barriers to achievement. Something that as we work with our education service districts, as we work with our community colleges extended cross-sector partners at the regional level, they have a critical role to play. Lastly, developing a coherent and seamless system of assessments from early childhood through post-secondary education. One of the pieces of work that we've done within the K-12 system, working with the Oregon Department of Education and other partners, is around how do we develop a more balanced system of assessment. And from that work, we see over time making sure that as we look to support both interim and formative assessments, that we are linking that assessment with our early learning and our higher ed sector. So those are some of our strategic goals and strategies.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. CEO Capps, thank you. Environmental factors impacting the educational system, I would recommend that you and the governor consider adding disaster issues, tsunamis, and also this committee heard the Board of Dentistry ask for $8,000 for security of their board meetings. Terrible reflection upon society. And so I think that I would recommend you and the governor consider putting also school safety. We've had disasters in this state, too many. And we've worked and we've tried to come up with solutions. The report that we came out with has the hotline and things like that. I think I've spoken to you about, I visited Ben High School last year and was terrified to learn how many students are on suicide watch. It's frightening and another terrible reflection on our society. So I would recommend that you and the governor maybe want to consider adding that into the environmental factors affecting.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, if I may respond. Mm-hmm. Certainly school safety is a statewide responsibility, one that the governor takes seriously. The distinction that I would make, and I think this is important in terms of differentiating our role as a planning and coordinating agency, is that some issues we intentionally recognize as being within the jurisdiction of specific agencies. And I think that was one of the areas of confusion that might have been created previously, unintended, through the Oregon Education Investment Board, was making sure that we delineated between areas of governance that are under the jurisdiction, school safety being obviously a State Board of Education responsibility, as well as the Oregon Department of Education. But to your point, school safety is an issue that we hear about everywhere. There are concerns about it, and it's a critical foundational responsibility of our educational system. So I appreciate the suggestion and happy to look into that.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, Lindsay. You're going to think you lived here soon.
As long as I don't wear out my welcome.
Okay. So I actually want to talk about the difference between Strategic Goal 1 and Strategic Goal 2. Now, a little of this is I'm an editor, and, you know, there are many words that we use a lot here and in education, pedagogy, you know, all that good stuff. But I feel like there is so much overlap between these two that I guess I'm not, I feel like there's, you know, and again, you guys are this now kind of streamlined, or the goal is to for you to be this streamlined organization, but coordinating cross-sector planning and policy development to achieve statewide goals for student learning outcomes and coordinating integrated cross-sector system that supports student success. Goals, the goal is always going to be student success, I would say, in the big picture. Mm-hmm. But then also there are, you know, the, under the first one, the key strategy one is develop educational goals across early learning, K-12, and education, higher education and workforce. And then under two, coordinate alignment of learning outcomes across. Mm-hmm. So there's just... I worry that we wander a little far off into the weeds about trying to, you know, make sure we say everything in seven different ways when that might potentially take away from the actual focus. And there are two bullets on number two that are kind of the same thing that I think is just an editing issue.
Yes.
But I did want to just comment on the, it feels like you just keep saying the same thing different ways in that. And you can argue that that's on purpose. Or I might argue that maybe there's a way to really, but perhaps by focusing the language, it can focus our you know, it can sharpen our focus as well.
Sure. Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, I think that's a fair question. The way that I would delineate the two, goal one and goal two, is there is a policy function. There is the establishment of statewide goals and statute. There is the work that we do with the legislature directly to move policy or resource allocation decisions that we see as a clear area of work. The other area of work is under goal two is some of the authorities that already exist across the system to change practices that they have in place or to better align support. So to give you an example of that, one might look at the fact that we have funded, for example, regional promise sites to look at that 11 through 14 transition. That's a legislative decision in which resources are allocated. There still is a layer of work that needs to happen across institutions that requires quite a bit of stakeholder convening. It means bringing together institutional leadership within the K-12 system, within the community college system. And I think what we're trying to delineate, and this came up a little bit in the, or should say a lot, in the Senate Bill 215 work group, is rather than thinking from an authoritative position of we'll just set policy and have the system follow that policy, that there also needs to be a recognition of the fact that we have authorities across the system that need to be connected around moving specific areas of work. And not all of that will require dollars or statutory changes. So that's the distinction. I would be happy to work on these goals as we go through this process because it needs to be clear for the legislature and for the public. And so if we are not reflecting that appropriately, which I think you've pointed out, we're happy to make amendments to that. And I do appreciate the comment.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
So along that line, yesterday we had a conversation about kids going to community colleges. And there is a policy thing about linking them. But there's also this idea of entering exams, which is a real down-in-the-earth kind of thing between people to make sure that we find one that actually aligns with K-12 so that we're not testing something different that we taught all the way through to get them into the program. And both of those take a different approach to get to a solution that affects kids directly. Because if you're taking courses over and you take a remedial class and you think, why did I take this class? I already knew all this stuff, but I spent a whole time and I don't get credit for it and all that kind of stuff. And I would have been successful, but the test told me I wasn't, so they don't let me do it. They take a long time to fix in the system right now. And I think there's a policy that everybody wants people to be in the right place and do the right thing. Then there's an application of that policy, which sometimes doesn't make any sense. So hopefully they can solve both those problems.
So the third and final agency strategic goal is sort of developing systems of support for educator advancement. We just talked a moment ago about two of the efforts that we have undertaken, one to diversify the education workforce, working with an education educator equity advisory committee, working cross-sector to develop strategies and practices to build pathways into the system. The other is our work to create an educator advancement council to develop regional educator networks. So those are two areas of work that are very much focused around developing better statewide systems to support the educator workforce we would like to see in the future. So environmental factors that, you know, currently impact our agency, and I'll go through these quickly since I think we've talked a little bit about the context, but certainly.
I'm not always such a bad editor. That's why I often just try to sit and watch. The number four, that's just that was from an earlier version. Because that sounds like it could be an agency goal as well. Collaborate with education agencies from cradle to career.
Yes, it is. It's
from a
function.
Previous.
Yeah, it's
okay.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. So just quickly going through some of the environmental factors. Obviously, changing student demographics, the diversity of our student population obviously requires us not only to be working with our educational institutions, but with communities to establish strategies that improve access, participation, and completion of education as they're moving from early learning through higher ed. We need a more diverse workforce to reflect that student body. Chronic absenteeism. When we think about our work to improve outcomes from being ready for school to third grade reading to high school graduation, this is a critical, probably long-term effort that we see coordination being necessary to achieve success. High school graduation, we have one of the worst high school graduation rates in the country, as we all know. And with a 74.8% graduation rate, there is critical work that we need to do specifically within the K-12 system, working with schools and communities, but certainly ways that we can think about that in a broader P-20 context that is critically important. System building. So I think this punctuates a little bit, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, your point. How are we working across educational entities to better coordinate and align our work? Sustainable funding. Obviously, we have a system that not only needs more resource, but I think in many respects, how do we use those resources the most effectively and in ways that will help to improve outcomes, most especially for our underserved students?
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So changing student demographics, and so I'm trying to understand, does that category include this whole health, family, all of those issues that impact schools? In many cases now, schools have become a service provider for a lot more things than schools were. So is that, from an environmental factor, is that captured in changing student demographics, or is it someplace else?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, yes, it's certainly reflected, and we need broad and diverse strategies to impact student outcomes, and that certainly are going to be academic factors. There's certainly going to be non-academic factors that we need to address.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, the only one that I see there that to me is missing is federal stuff. I mean, they change what we have to do. And sometimes we don't align the changes, so now we're doing two reports instead of one. And it would be nice if we always kept note that there's this other group out there that's impacting us in little
yes.
ways, like ESSA and
yes.
others. Okay. But.
Okay. agency staff and structure. So we have a 19 person agency. We are divided up between the chief education officer, in this capacity I serve as the administrator of the agency, our education innovation officer, who has a specific focus around practices and strategies targeted to high school graduation outcomes. We have a policy team that includes our college and career readiness educator advancement director, our CT and STEAM education policy director, and we have a public affairs director who works to support our community engagement and stakeholder engagement efforts, as well as helping to manage some of our interagency work. Tied to that team is our regional education partnership policy advisor that works specifically with our regional achievement collaboratives as the key state point of contact with the RACs, as well as working across regional collaboratives such as the early learning hubs and supporting the work of the STEM hubs along with our CT and STEAM education director. We have a research unit led by our interagency policy research director, and with a mixed methods research team that do both qualitative and quantitative research. And then we have a statewide longitudinal data team, which is essentially building our statewide longitudinal data system. These are IT specialists that are working to deliver that system by the end of 2017. In addition to that, we have our operations director that oversees the agency's budget and staffing needs. Any questions on that? Yes.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. Again, one of the complaints I get from constituents, my school districts, is that we continue to build structure and people at the state level that don't have direct impact on kids, and therefore this agency has gotten much larger. I haven't seen HEC get smaller or Department of Ed get smaller or Early Learning Group get smaller or our youth and whatever get smaller. So here we go spending a lot of money on a lot of people who have no direct influence on kids. So I just have to bring that up because this is a bigger chart than it used to be.
Yeah. So, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, one of the reasons that we have a larger agency, though our budget has gone down over time, is the addition of a larger longitudinal data team that is really working to build the system. I think the other point that I would make, because certainly having more resources, working with our students every day is critically important. Part of what our policy and research team is doing is helping to facilitate some of this cross-agency and cross-sector work. Convening stakeholders, convening organizations and institutions to really help remove barriers for us that might get in the way of student learning, and to help work with the legislature, most importantly, to move policies forward that better connect our system. So I think this agency is certainly additive in trying to make a system that works better. And I think if we do our job right with our partner agencies, we should be making life easier for our teachers and school leaders on the front lines, as well as our early learning providers and higher ed faculty. So,
hello.
Go ahead.
I would agree. I don't think they feel it yet. So I want to make sure that people realize that they're not feeling the love that I think is embedded in this in a lot of different ways. And I mean, I have great hope for the database making things easier. I mean, if it actually fit into my brain's way it should go, school districts wouldn't have to fill out nearly as many forms because they could send it to one place and they could use the database to fill out all the forms, and we wouldn't have to do that. But it hasn't got there yet, so it makes it, in especially in times when we see diminished resources, it makes it hard for people.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So further on that, so I see, I'm assuming this longitudinal data system, we didn't have a system before,
mm-hmm.
So this is a new system. And so then I also assume then, given the number of steps there, that once the system's in place, it'll take fewer people to maintain the system than it is taken to build the system?
Potentially, yeah. I think one of the things that will become more connective once the system is up is, as we look at the research team, which initially when the agency was created, I think there was a proposal at that time actually coming from both our K-12 and higher ed sectors to build out a research team of eight or more, mm-hmm. in part to be able to utilize the statewide longitudinal data system to do very specific research. So if we're trying to figure out what's really getting in the way of us achieving third grade benchmark for most of our students, how might we align a research strategy or a research agenda to look into that issue? And I think there's real potential there for this research unit to, especially as we think efficiently about how it might connect with external research capacity, either through our university system or other research institutions, how they might be able to get to some very Oregon-specific information that then informs policy and strategies that help us move more quickly to getting student outcomes.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. One quick question, one maybe not as quick. So on the board administrator, so that person oversees the state school board, so that is also kind of in your purview, or no, or is this a different board that's being referred to? The board that formerly was the OEIB?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, great question. So the board administrator position, this is our current structure for the 2015-17 biennium. This position was the board administrator for the Oregon Educator or Education Investment Board. They were also our rules administrator and public meetings officer. Mm-hmm. This position ended in 2015. By the requirements of us presenting to you our current structure, that's reflected in there, but that position will go away in the subsequent biennium.
Okay, great.
That at least is the recommendation.
Okay, and then I think that was the short question, but maybe this will be.
Sorry for the long answer.
No, that was good. And then I heard you say when Senator Roblin asked about how numerically it's bigger, but even though financially it's smaller, but then did you actually say specifically how that happened, or did I stop listening for a minute, or did that not? Because I sometimes
thank
do that.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith-Warner.
I'm sorry.
We'll
want to just get to that in that. Yeah. Great. Super. Thank you.
So now we'll shift to talk about specific functions of the Chief Education Office. So part of our work, as we've talked about, is really developing a more equitable system, ensuring access, participation, and outcomes for our underserved students. And so we're thinking about this work really across the P20 continuum. Again, to speak to some of the questions that have come up before, you know, one of our key functions, being a nimble and light agency, is the opportunity to convene with stakeholders and communities to co-construct powerful solutions. One of the important sort of theory of action approaches that we have is that efforts that we can undertake to support enhanced student outcomes will largely differ from community to community, from region to region. So we can certainly set both concrete and aspirational goals for improving statewide outcomes. How we do that in certain parts of the state may look different than in others. And so part of what we want to do, and certainly this is reflected in the work of our Education Innovation Officer, is to create, I think, a communication loop between what's happening on the ground in our communities and policymakers, and most especially the legislature, to identify strategies that will be effective and allow for that customization. So part of our work, and it's certainly reflected in our research, is to get community input on policy. And we can look at other state models and other statewide state policies across the country and see how those apply. That's an important process. But some of it is also to ground truth that to conditions and experiences on the ground, most especially for communities most in the gap in terms of opportunity and achievement. Certainly, we've talked about enhanced coordination with agency leaders and, importantly, our boards, working with the Early Learning Council, the Youth Development Council, the State Board of Education, the Higher Education Coordinating Council, and the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. These are areas where we can work through their administrative functions to move enhanced strategies and practices. And then one of the key pieces that we keep in front of us as we convene interagency teams in specific areas of work is to really view that work through the lens of the statewide equity lens. So how are these decisions around policy and resource allocation or other strategies reflecting efforts to improve outcomes for those students most in need? And last, as is emerging, our opportunity to use longitudinal data to help inform this work.
Senator Roblin.
Just a comment on in 215 work group that a lot of people in it, the two in here that were really important to the equity lens, that they felt this was the only place that really took that on across the system. So that was a really important part. The other one had to do with putting TSPC into the in the group, because previous to 215 it was outside all by itself, and having them all together made sense to people. So
and when we get Monica back on, we can talk to her some more about, because she's actually in the past been in a system where TSPC was a part of the Department of Ed.
And then it was out.
Now it's separate. And I ask her in my private meetings with her which is better. And she said both have their advantages and disadvantages. And so we're going to get a chance to talk to her about that tomorrow, I guess. Lindsay, go ahead.
So we've talked already a little bit about the equity lens in our previous presentation, but certainly one of the key premises of this is that as we improve educational equity, it is both an enhancement to us as a statewide community and certainly for our economic benefit in the future. The other piece that I would just highlight in terms of the equity lens is the important beliefs that I think it frames culturally for our system in terms of our educators and institutional leaders and certainly for our communities. First and foremost, that we can achieve so much through partnership, and that that's a critical element of our work, and that outreach to those who are working with our students, whether those are within institutions or within the community, that is a critical bridge for us to build. But it also has a really important focus, which is how we use interventions, supports, and investments to really target the students who have persistently been underserved and remain in our achievement gaps. And that's an important partnership that we see on the executive branch side with the legislature as well in making sure the equity lens is followed in our policymaking. So now I'll turn to some of our key performance measures as an agency. And given some of our coordinating efforts across the system around chronic absenteeism, we have two performance measures in that realm. As you'll see on the chart here, we have a target of 90% not chronically absent. We made some gains in 2015 with 88% being our statewide number. We've seen a drop of 1% in 2016. We think that a lot of the work that we have done with the Oregon Department of Education in particular, and to some degree with the Early Learning Division, to develop a statewide plan for chronic absenteeism will help us move that number, since many of the strategies called forth within that plan, I think will help support schools being more effective working with communities to address student attendance.
Representative Lively.
Mr. Co-Chair, thank you. So define for me chronically absent, since the goal is to increase the percentage of students not chronically absent. Then help me understand this. How do we define chronically absent?
Yeah, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner. Chronically absent is defined as 10% in a given school year. So in a 22-day, 22 school days within a month, that's roughly three or more days. I think the important thing to also keep in mind is that any absence is a barrier to students remaining on track. So we certainly are trying to maintain a high standard in terms of how we measure that. So now we'll turn to ninth grade attendance, and similarly, we saw a 83% not chronically absent measure statewide in 2015, and have also seen a drop of about 1% and across all groups. Third performance measure is around increasing the percentage of educators who are culturally and linguistically diverse. We've talked about the statutory charge we have in this regard to report on that. In 2014-15, less than 1 in 10 public school teachers were individuals of color, while more than one-third or 36% of Oregon public school students are individuals of color. So we have a ways to go. We have made slight gains between 2015 and 2016. On our way to a 20% target, as we've established it. And we believe that certainly our proposals around an educator advancement council with a focus around how we engage in recruitment strategies across the system can help us move that number. So as with many agencies, we have a customer service requirement, and we have two measures in this regard. I will tell you this has been a somewhat of a confounding area for us, not the least of which in terms of participation in our survey. We had 37 respondents who have responded both to our research and policy service and our agency overall. We take this measure very seriously, and we, in establishing the criteria that we put out in which we're measuring ourselves, we've wanted to be very accurate about how folks are viewing our agency and our research team in particular. I think what's important to note here is that we're not doing very well. To be very blunt with you, our target going forward in terms of our great or excellent rating, you know, being above 80%, we're in the 60% range on that now. Some of that, as we have been trying to analyze this, and again, our surveys are anonymous, so it's hard for us to know exactly who responded, but has really been to think about who our key customers are. And so as we've looked at that measure, whereas under the Oregon Education Investment Board, it was broadly sort of any stakeholder across the system, where we have focused that is really being on our agencies, the policy work that we convene, and with our research customers. So we are doing some effort right now to, even as we have a summative measure that we report back to you on as the legislature, to do some formative surveys that are project specific so that we can glean a little bit better information and report that back out.
And you said the rate of response is very low?
Yes.
So sometimes people that are cranky are more likely to respond, whereas people that are okay with the way things are going may be less likely to respond. That might have an effect on your outcomes here.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warren, I appreciate that analysis. I do think we still take it very seriously that when it comes to the service or accuracy or effectiveness of the agency, that we have higher numbers going forward.
In a way, so it reminds me of the call-in surveys that television and radio stations have, you know, where, you know, you phone in if you're mad, and you, so it skews the numbers, and it's not reflective of a scientific survey.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Co-Chair Monroe, thank you. We're looking at how we better can disseminate the survey so we get
a
more
good
widespread response.
Mr. Chair, I think this probably would be a decent place to break for the day. This was public testimony day for this agency's budget, but since everyone in the room looks like it's staff of one type or another, I believe, I don't think anyone signed up, but the opportunity is there.
And were we going to hear from Lisa sometime?
That would be at the end of the presentation, probably tomorrow.
Okay, Lisa, be ready tomorrow. Anything else? Mr. Capps, thank you very much. This has been very informative. And we will all adjourn until tomorrow.